Ms., may I ask a preliminary question?
Yes, sir.
Assuming argumento, assuming it's the case, the evidentiary rule excludes recent complaint testimony of a sexual act, excluding rape. In the absence of testimony by the victim as to the underlying act, that's your argument, I gather, on brief. What is the reason for that rule of evidence?
The reason to...
To exclude... Exclude recent complaint.
To exclude recent complaint if the complainant doesn't testify?
Is it possible that the reason is because there's no evidence of the underlying act?
No. So I think the court is getting to the position advanced by the Attorney General in this case, which is the position taken by the McManus panel that their recent complaint corroborates the occurrence of the crime
I'm
itself.
I'm assuming your argument is correct on the evidence. But why is that rule exit? Isn't it because there's no evidence of the underlying act? There's just recent complaints when the victim does not testify. Is that why that rule is operative?
So I'm not quite sure I understand the court's question. I think the purpose of the recent complaint rule and the reason why it's admissible when the complainant testifies is, as laid out in the historical background, to refute the accusation that it's untrue or made up. The hue and cry rule was discarded, okay. But the purpose of admitting the recent complaint is to show that the complainant
is
truthful. So you're saying
that the reason why a victim has to testify is because it might have been made up, you know, a claim of an ultimate act. What I'm saying is the underlying act is not established unless the victim testifies to it, and for that reason, recent complaints are not admissible. Is that your understanding of the law?
Sort of, and that's kind of a weird way to answer the question.
But in this case, there isn't any question that the underlying act occurred, is there?
So in this case, there's an extrajudicial confession that, once the confession is made to Detective Hegemuel, would establish the elements for an aggravated sexual battery. But the law is very...
Your client's defense wasn't that it didn't happen. Your client's defense was, well, it happened, but I didn't have the requisite intent.
I don't believe so. Our argument in the trial court was that the Commonwealth didn't prove the offense beyond a reasonable doubt because an extrajudicial confession is one in which there must be corroboration to make sure
setting
there's
aside
the veracity.
The corroboration question, there isn't any question that the act occurred according to your client's testimony, is there?
I take issue with that because the whole purpose of the slight corroboration requirement for extrajudicial confessions is that the extrajudicial confession may not be accurate.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, let me try it this way. What is, assuming that you are correct in terms of the fact that the testimony should not have been allowed in, that it violates the statute,
yes.
What is there to present or prevent this from being harmless? Because you've got the extrajudicial confession, and then why wouldn't the testimony of the same nurse be the corroboration?
Because the testimony from the same nurse is not discussing a specific injury or expression of pain that the victim experienced during the alleged assault. The only evidence from the examination was the complainant saying that she was in pain during the exam.
And but didn't the same nurse say that that was unusual for a person of that age?
The question on page 326 of the record was, it's not uncommon that a six-year-old could feel some pain. Answer, usually they don't, but it's not uncommon that she would have felt uncomfortable. And I think what's significant
here... But didn't it go on to indicate that the pain wouldn't have occurred during the examination?
She said that ordinarily they don't feel pain during the exam. However, in examining the record as a whole, there are a multitude of other reasons that could have explained why this complainant experienced pain during the actual examination that
except
had nothing.
Except none of them appeared to be present in the medical information at that current time. She wasn't suffering from a UTI or vaginitis or anything of that nature.
However,
those are the things that she had suffered from in the past. and that the mother reported had not occurred for several months. And those are the things that the same nurse indicated could cause pain. So isn't there the ability for the trier of fact to find then that the same nurse's testimony would have corroborated the confession?
No. I want to clarify one thing. There was testimony that there was pain urinating within the prior 2 weeks, and that's just the general time frame that they used. So there was that evidence, at least. We don't know when, but there was pain urinating during the prior 2 weeks.
But aren't these all things that the trier of fact could take into account in making a determination about which specifics of the testimony to find credible and believable versus which not to?
Yes, but going back to Judge Malveaux's question also, there was also significant evidence in the record that for the last 4 years or so, this complainant had a habit of touching herself with her fingers or using a blanket between her legs to manipulate that part of her body. And so if we're talking about a charge of aggravated sexual battery, which requires some sort of touching of the genitals, and we also have a complainant whose the testimony is daily touching herself in that area on her own, then if we look at the Allen principle, that if the facts offered to prove the commission of the offense are just as consistent with non-commission of the offense, then we don't have slight corroboration by the mere expression of pain, because that pain could have been easily attributable to her own fingers having touched herself.
Does that flow from something in the evidence? Did somebody testify to that?
Yes, there was testimony from the mother throughout.
I know there was testimony about her putting her hands down there and all of that. There was plenty of that testimony. But is there anything to connect that with pain?
Well, if the inference is that the pain experienced during the exam was a result of a touching of that area, the aggravated sexual battery, then a touching by the own child would certainly be just as consistent with non-commission as it is consistent with the offense. And so the actual touching that this little girl does on a daily basis is actually very significant to establish that an expression of pain experienced during the exam when, again, she's in an unfamiliar area with a stranger. Basically, the testimony was spreading, I think, the outer lips of her vagina apart, touching her in that intimate area. If the expression of pain is all that the Commonwealth can point to and not actual injury, redness, perforation like there has been in other cases, then that expression of pain, if we want to say it's a result of Mr. Garcia Davila, then it's just as likely to have been from her own fingers touching herself, which she's been doing for 4 years or so on a daily basis. And so, no, I would say that the pain does not provide that slight corroboration, and that was actually something the trial court on its own said during its ruling it could or couldn't be. And that's what the trial court's kind of basis for denying the motion to strike was and the motion to set aside the verdict was. It could or it couldn't be, and that's a jury determination, but it's actually a legal determination the court could have made, because under Allen, when the facts, again, are equally as consistent with non-commission of the offense as with its commission, then there is no slight corroboration. So no, the pain would not provide that evidence.
So your position is that it's a legal determination,
yes,
not a factual determination.
Yes, and that's why it was error to deny the renewed motion and the motion to strike. The other piece of evidence that the Attorney General points to is the proximity, the fact that Mr. Garcia Davila was home with the complaining witness the morning when the complaint was later made. And again, if we look at Allen and we talk about whether in that case mere proximity, mere presence in the home was enough to provide slight corroboration, it wasn't.
What about his reaction when he was confronted by the mother?
Again,
is not the statement.
I take the position that it is, that the statement or admission is all part of the extrajudicial confession.
Well, what case law do you have to support that?
I think if we consider how this plays out in court.
Do you have a case?
I don't have a case that says that specifically looking at how he responds is going to be included as part of the extrajudicial confession, but we know that when evidence is played for the jury, a videotaped confession, that statement and how it's viewed by the jury includes their ability to observe the defendant's demeanor during the statement, his positioning, his eye movement, his mannerisms.
But if you have something that is a reaction as opposed to the later confession, aren't those two items detached?
No, because the statements that came in through his wife were still part of the extrajudicial admission or confession. Those certainly didn't rise to the level of a quote-unquote confession because it didn't actually move the ball forward in terms of whether the elements of proof were met, but it was an extrajudicial admission that was offered. In sum, with the apology letter, with the statement to Detective Hagenmuehl, and with the controlled call. All of those things taken together can't bootstrap onto one another. The purpose of extrajudicial confessions is that things that happen outside the courtroom have to be corroborated. That testimony was a conversation that occurred outside the courtroom, and so that taken as a whole is the extrajudicial confession, just as in Allen, where the statements to the police and the statements to his daughter formed the extrajudicial confession.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal time. You certainly may continue if you wish, or you may reserve the balance.
I'll reserve. Thank you. Okay.
Ms. Bourne?
May it please the Court, Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I'd like to address the harmless error issue first, if I may. And I think that I would argue that there was much more than just the one thing that counsel has pointed to. First of all, there was testimony that the child exhibited sexualized behavior, unobjected to. That corroborates his very detailed confession that he sexually assaulted her. There was testimony that she had pain during
sexualized behavior. Could there be evidence of her prior touching that might be implicated in that?
Here is, I think, the issue that I have. When we need corroboration of an extrajudicial confession, the corpus delicti is actually proven through the confession. So we have all of the elements that are proven through the confession. We don't have to have everything else consistent
with guilt. No, I
understand.
It's just slight. That's not my question. My question is specifically as to the first thing that you noted in terms of the sexualized behavior. I mean, obviously, when we look at the evidence and what flows from it in terms of the slight cooperation, and if we're using just the sexualized behavior, is there an issue or a problem with that given the fact that there has been there's a replete amount of testimony about her prior touching?
No, because I would argue that the sexualized behavior, it could be a result of what her sexual abuse. And, you know, certainly I have a list of things, so that's just one in many, and I think that they have to be viewed in total, because both circumstantial evidence and direct evidence can corroborate. So we have that. We have pain with urination. We have pain during the genital exam, which, as you noted, the same nurse said was not normal. We had the opportunity, which we know alone is not enough, but it can be used as one of many circumstances. So he was alone with the child prior to this being reported on the same day. In fact, she was wearing, during the confession, there was some discussion. He was very detailed about what she was wearing. And she, in fact, was wearing a tank top, a white tank top, which corroborated the detail of what he said during his confession. He was shaking and crying during when he was confronted by the mother.
Let's focus in a little bit on that. You know, it's Ms. Donahue's position that's all part and parcel to the confession, that his reaction and, you know, his response to the wife is all part of the later confession. What's the Commonwealth's position on that?
Absolutely not. That's circumstantial evidence of his demeanor, which is not the purpose of the corpus delicti rule, and is that we don't want to have, we want to have false confessions. So it is, the purpose is to prevent false confessions. And there's a long discussion about that in Allen. And there's simply no evidence of that here. And excluding that piece of evidence as part of the confession, I mean, that is a circumstantial piece of evidence that tends to show that he's not making a false confession.
But just so I'm, okay, so just so I'm sure I'm clear on your position, the crying and shaking, which was the reaction to when she confronted him, was not part, in your estimation,
no, Your Honor,
was not part of the
confession. It's circumstantial evidence of his demeanor, which I would argue is consistent with the fact that it's not a false confession. And along with all of these other things, is corroborative. And I also would argue that he told multiple different stories. And these multiple different stories are not part of the confession. And we know from case law, long case law in this court, that when the defendant tells lies to the police, that can be considered as independent evidence of his guilt. And so I would note that the fact that he told multiple different stories about how this took place and minimized his own actions as far as saying, well, I touched her, but it was accidental. And this was, as the court, I think, observed during its decision in this case, said that this was like an evolving story. And the fact that he had an evolving story, I think, also is a corroborative circumstance that can be considered. So we have multiple things that corroborate his very detailed confession in this case. And for those reasons, I would argue that this was harmless error, if it was error. And
do you disagree with opposing counsel's position that the touching by the child could just as easily be, it's in equipoise with the touching by him? So in other words, if there's evidence that she touched herself, and there's also evidence that he touched her, that you don't get the benefit of a jury decision on
that. No, I don't, because first of all, there was no evidence that she touched herself that day. In fact, she was with the grandfather all day long when this happened. And there was no evidence that she had vaginitis at that time. There was no evidence that she had a UTI at that time. In fact, the evidence was that she did not have a UTI at that time. The mother said she didn't even know what vaginitis was. I mean, what the mother could have told her was, look, she's complaining of pain. And that could have been, you know, the nurses saying, well, then she said she had vaginitis. So those things were actually excluded. But I would say that the court, when we're looking at what is slight corroboration, we're looking at all of these things. And all of these things corroborate together that, and it's an issue of fact for the court to determine, I would argue. And he found all of these things together. He listed a number of issues that he felt corroborated the confession. And we're talking here, when harmless error, about whether there's been a fair trial on the merits and substantial justice has been achieved. And clearly that happened in this case. If I could move on to the recent complaint exception briefly. You know, under Woodward and under McManus.
How is that not an opposite? Because, I mean, that was decided before the rule was actually enacted.
Well, McManus was decided before the rule was in what the statute.
No. Well, so the rule was actually passed in July of that year before.
And then Terry also, they discussed this case and said the same thing. So I would say that it has not abrogated the common law. The purpose of the statute was to codify the common law, and we know this.
Well, then what do you say about Jenkins? Because Jenkins actually takes a position that supports what the appellant is advocating, which is, in fact, that the only statements that can come in by other people about the complaint are there simply for cooperative purposes.
Well, I would argue that there was another problem in Jenkins. And I think that statement in Jenkins was dicta because there was a footnote that said, look, we're not really called upon to answer this question here.
That's in Jenkins.
In Jenkins. And I would.
And Jenkins is a Supreme Court of Virginia case.
Yes, it is.
And so Supreme Court of Virginia dicta is pretty persuasive for this court, is it not?
Well, I'm just saying that nobody has overruled McManus, nobody has overruled Woodward, and we still are saying the same things in Terry, and all of this is after Jenkins. Well, Terry is definitely. But what I would say is that that's dicta, and what they're saying there is that there was another problem, which was that it was offered as independent evidence. So unlike this case where it's not offered as independent evidence.
Is your argument that it's simply just corroborative of the confession?
It's corroborative of the confession. And, you know, the real problem is that in McManus, there's some great language in McManus and in Woodward that talks about, look, the purpose is not just.
Let me back up and ask you a question, not to interrupt you, but if your indication is that it's just corroborative of the confession, how does that impact or implicate the rule? Would your indication be that it doesn't, and that the rule is therefore not something the court could consider? And if that's correct, the court in this particular case actually did make a ruling on the particular rule and whether it was applicable?
Well, what I would say is that the rule, first of all, the rule and the statute doesn't say that you have to have evidence. It doesn't specifically say that you have to have evidence, the victim's testimony before you can admit this evidence. I would take issue with the language of the rule at the outset. It says that it's not admissible for independent evidence and that it is admissible to corroborate the
testimony. But aren't we supposed to give the statute the plain reading
But
of
we
it?
Know, but we know that the purpose of, from other case law, that the purpose of that rule and statute are to codify the common law rule.
As it relates to rape. And they added the sexual assault.
And to expand it.
Well, but they added the sexual assault. In this particular case, we actually do have legislative history where it actually talked about the fact that it wasn't there for independent corroboration.
Well, it's not there for independent corroboration, but it also doesn't, the legislative history does not say it's only there to corroborate the testimony. So it's there to corroborate, I would argue, any evidence of the offense, any independent evidence of the offense. Let's look at how absurd it is to limit it in this fashion, where you have a full confession, and we have a child, any child under the age of 6 years old is going to be unlikely to be able to testify. So if you have a full confession, and of course we know the problem with confessions is we have to have, because of the corpus delicti rule, we have to have some corroboration. And so in any case where we have a minor child who is too incompetent to testify, then we just simply cannot get a conviction even where that child has made a statement because she will not be able to testify. There may not be any physical evidence other than, you know, some complaint of pain or something like that in those cases. And there, because we know that in 50%, as the nurse said, of such cases, there is no physical evidence. There is no redness. There is no tearing. There is nothing like that. So you could get a conviction where the child testified and then was corroborated by a recent complaint. But in the much stronger case where you have a full judicial confession and we have a child that can corroborate that, you can't get a conviction. So that is just an absurd result. And it also is at odds with the language of McManus and Woodward, where they talk about there is no reason why it should be limited to that purpose, that it is too narrowly limited the scope of the function of the recent complaint evidence.
Well, but in Woodard, the victim testified, right?
That's right. But they also said it also corroborates the other.
Oh. Yeah.
It also corroborates the other evidence, and they went out of their way to say that. Well, you went out of their way to say that. So, therefore, it wasn't just corroborative of the recent complaint exception. It was also, the testimony, but it was also corroborative of other circumstances of guilt. For that reason, I would ask that you affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Dunhay? Let me start by asking a question that I asked Ms. Bourne, which is, why wouldn't the statement just be corroborative of the confession?
Because if we're looking at the plain language of that rule and that statute, it's admissible just to corroborate the complainant's testimony, to refute the belief that it was untrue. It's not supposed to have an independent evidentiary value or any other corroborative value.
Well, counsel is pointing to McManus and indicating that there are two different elements to it, one of which is that it is for the purpose of corroborating the testimony, but also corroborating other evidence. What is your position on that?
Well, McManus, the complainant didn't testify.
I'm sorry, I meant Woodard. I apologize.
Okay. So Woodard didn't really deal with this issue because the complainant did testify, and really the issue only comes up because of a jury instruction issue. The real issue was recency of the complaint. And so I don't believe Woodard is really at all relevant to this determination because it is so factually inopposite. They took the holding from McManus, decided 1 year prior, and reiterated it, but didn't actually discuss it in the same way. It was literally just a jury instruction issue that was being brought before the court and whether it properly stated the law. I take issue with the fact that recent complaint can be used to corroborate a confession in the absence of someone testifying because, again, historically, through the common law, the Supreme Court precedents, and even in our own court, this court, prior to McManus, the purpose for the recent complaint was to corroborate only the complaining witness's testimony. The statute is plain. It's not ambiguous. There is no ambiguity that was necessary to be clarified by the McManus or subsequent decisions like Woodard and its progeny. And it's significant, I think, that though McManus and Woodard stood for this proposition, McManus is the only one that was actually factually similar. No other case has considered that. But yet our Supreme Court in Jenkins, and yes, it is in dicta, but it does suggest that it's not applicable if the person doesn't testify. That is when it becomes admissible. So the erroneous admission of that evidence in this trial was not harmless error.
What do you make of footnote 5 in Jenkins?
It's a footnote that's there, and yet even with the footnote, in the body of the opinion, it still goes on to say that the rule isn't up and applicable because the child didn't testify.
Well, so I hear you, but doesn't that footnote say we're reserving judgment on that very issue that you're...
The footnote would seem to suggest it, but the body of the opinion, says otherwise. And again, because McManus was decided, I think, in April or March of 1993, and then the statute was into effect in July, essentially that statute overruled McManus. And there is no amendment that would have been necessary to the statute to say otherwise, because the statute is very clear. It doesn't say that it's admissible for any other purpose or to corroborate any other part of the evidence that the Commonwealth introduces. So I do believe that the admission of the recent complaint was not harmless error. The jury was instructed that they could use the slight corroboration, use the recent complaint as slight corroboration in this case, and the trial court certainly relied upon it in finding that there was sufficient evidence to set this case to the jury and not deny the motion, and did not deny the motion to strike and motion to set aside the verdict in this case. Just going back briefly to the idea of the sexualized behavior, I just want to remind the court that the record in this case said that sexualized behavior was occurring years prior and that Mr. Garcia Davila was not even in this child's life for those years. He was only in her life for approximately 2 or 3 months before the offense. So that sexualized behavior that was exhibited over years is in no way attributable in that period of time to him. All these reasons, we'd ask the court to dismiss on assignment of number 2 or in the alternative remand for a new trial, or certainly if the court feels that McManus needs to be revisited, take further steps.
Thank you. We will come down.